Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, March 14th, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. On March 7th, 1 week ago today, Lyndon LaRouche issued a declaration of war against the British Empire and its Wall Street assets. While the immediate cause for this declaration was the accelerated efforts by London-based fascist forces to destroy the current U.S. presidency, today on the program, we will be investigating the larger arena of this war and why we must either defeat the British Empire or prepare for a prolonged dark age. Today is the 130th anniversary of the birth of Albert Einstein. Einstein was one of the last conscious links to the scientific tradition, which has lifted mankind from the backwardness to which Britain's Prince Charles would like to return us. As LaRouche has identified in his writings over the last 40 years, this scientific tradition is based on developing the unique quality which separates man from the animals, the power of human creativity, specifically to develop new hypotheses concerning the nature of the physical universe and man's relation to it. In recent years, as members of the LaRouche Youth Movement took up the challenge from LaRouche to make the scientific method of great thinkers, from Kuza and Kepler to Leibniz and Riemann, their own, there's been a rotation of LIM members into what has become known as the basement, where they can work together with some direct input from LaRouche on the most important scientific questions facing mankind today. For the next hour, you will have the opportunity to hear from some of the participants in the basement. I hope this program will make clear to you, our listeners, why the battle for real science, taken at the most profound level, is essential if we are to win the war against the fascists of the Anglo-Dutch liberal empire. Joining me today will be Sky Shields, Ouyang Teng, and Megan Roulard, and I'd like to welcome you to the program.
Thanks.
Sky, let me start with you. As you may know, there is a lot of intrigue outside the organization from our supporters as to what is this basement. And in fact, someone actually wrote in once and said, why do we have people locked in the basement?
Oh, great.
So as someone who's been in the basement for the longest time, why don't you just give us a little sense of what's going on in the basement? What's this process that you're involved in?
Well, I'll say people might or might not be surprised to hear that, yes, it really is a basement. There are, however, windows, and they're not little tiny ones that are high up where you can't escape from. They're kind of large ones that are somewhat people-sized.
Well, that's why our program today is called The View from the Basement, so proceed.
Because we can, in fact, see, yes.
Yes.
That's good. No, but the idea is, I mean, it was actually sort of, we got excited a year or so ago when some of our enemies, who tend to not be very bright, you know, they're rather... Anybody who would disagree with Lynn on these fundamental matters, particularly given the situation we're in right now, economically, politically, strategically, you know, can't be the brightest bulb ever, the sharpest tool in the box. But one thing that they did a couple of years ago on one of these little gossip sites, the basement was dubbed LaRouche's Skunk Works, and we decided we sort of liked that. So we'll stick with it. But that's the idea. Lynn's always been stressing that for human society in general, and definitely for our political movement in particular, because representing sort of the front end of development of human society, you want to make sure that you've always got as your front end the real questions of what is human creativity? What is it, something that's an idea that's constantly developing of what is this quality of the human individual that makes us unique in the universe as a whole, makes us capable of the type of social organizations that we need in order to develop, and capable of making the type of discoveries in physical science and other studies that make us capable of that kind of social development. That's always got to be the front end of everything you're doing in economics, policy, strategy, etc. And so our goal is to represent that with a particular study of human creativity, both historically, but an application of that in the present day.
And have you been surprised from this study to find that at virtually every point of advance in science, it's been in the context of a war.
It's good, and the people are clear on it. One thing is that's been, you know, exciting and inspiring is because you get the recognition that the tendency is to think that, you know, look, we're in a pretty fucked up situation right now that we've had for, you know, ourselves. I'm 28, but in general for my generation and definitely for anybody younger, you get the impression that you've been cut off really from all human history. We're in a real dark age, economically, politically. We're watching the, you know, what could potentially be the collapse of human civilization as we know it for a number of generations. And so you think that maybe we got the short end of the stick. But then, yeah, you do a survey of this historical development, especially we're looking a lot right now at some of these early 20th century developments. And you realize that, you know, which we may be worse off than at some other points. But in general, yeah, this sort of fight is what people are in the middle of. I mean, some of the main thinkers that Lynn likes to cite, LaRouche likes to cite on this topic, were operating in the same or in some cases worse circumstances than what we're operating with.
Mm-hmm.
Einstein, for instance, most likely had, through his education, had a firmer connection to history than most of us were brought up with, the history of ideas, yes, in his quote-unquote area of science, but also as his exposure to classical culture, you know, his writing experience, classical musical composition, these things. But obviously, he was operating under conditions that were hazardous to his life, enough that he had to leave his home country, travel to the U.S., in order to escape the precursors, people who are the precursors to the exact same enemy that we're fighting right now.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the fascists who promoted the people who promoted fascism in Europe, and particularly the Nazis in Germany that Einstein was escaping, are the exact same people right now who are pushing for the current bailout programs and who are pushing to make the population eat this economic crisis we're in the middle of right now, rather than the people who should be paying for this, which are the people who created it in the first place.
Well, we'll be putting out a pamphlet sometime soon on the fascists then and now that will discuss exactly what you're talking about, that the same networks that are pushing not just for a bailout, but a bailout to establish a global fascist regime that would take what Mussolini and Hitler did in Italy and Germany and impose it internationally. So that's an important point. Now, Ouyang, let me ask you a question, because this is, again, we're talking about this the work being done by members of the LaRouche Youth Movement on advanced science and the application of that science to the social dynamic processes of developing civilization. And what LaRouche once again reiterated today in the talks with you out at Windy Hill was that we face a dark age if we don't succeed. Now, a lot of our listeners are familiar with Lynn talking about a new dark age, but from your standpoint, what do we mean when we say we're heading into or are already in a dark age? Ouyang?
I mean, I think part of the problem with discussing it is you have to sort of realize that to a large degree it's here. For example, we're doing a project right now. It's sort of around the last 2 weeks we've just been tasked with a project to do some animations and put together a short composition on the development of Africa. And it was somewhat timed to coincide with the conference that was recently just finished in Germany, which took up some of the same themes. And there, you have a clear picture. The fact that LaRouche and his wife Helga have both said that the development of Africa is going to be a litmus test for any new world economic order that comes into being, initiated from the United States, makes sense in the context of realizing that the kinds of conditions that result from a lack of basic infrastructure, the social upheavals, the political crises, they've all been taken to their extreme in parts of the world like Africa. And a major component of our fight against that now is going after the sort of not just the explicit funders and promoters of this, but also the philosophical promotion of this in the United States through people like George Soros, through the campaigns around drug legalization, where you really have a confluence between major strategic issues, geopolitical issues, about what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening in Central Asia, what's happening in South America, and the most direct, the most distilled kind of philosophical battle around what the nature of man is. And I think in particular this drug question is highlights that, because you have what's at stake is not just it's not a single issue. And so I think the organizing challenge, the conceptual difficulty that people have to overcome is compartmentalizing those problems and recognizing that to overcome it is not a question of understanding a particular policy or a particular array of policies, but is to overcome the conceptual gulf between how human beings think, the kinds of ideas that organize society, and then how that then is translated into the actions that societies take and individuals take. So we're hopefully that's clear in the kind of work that we're doing here on the fundamental questions of epistemology and science and history.
Well, I want to get to some of those questions in a moment. We already have an email that came in, which we'll put off for a little bit later in the program, but it's someone who's asking for an explanation of Einstein's thought process and relativity theory. So clearly some of the listeners are interested in these more deep, profound ideas. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, and if you do have questions, we'll try to get to them. You can email us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And I'm speaking with Sky Shields, Ouyang Teng, and Megan Roulard. Megan, did you get on?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Well, one of the things that Sky brought up earlier was this question of human creativity. Ouyang referred to it also. How do you, when you're explaining to people, when you're organizing, and you run into people who say, well, I don't see any difference between man and an animal, how do you answer that question?
Well, it seems like a pretty basic and fundamental question. I've sort of been trying to think about it again from a different standpoint. I guess I've been reading recently some of the writings of Helen Keller, and this has made this question a lot more clear in my mind than it has been even over the past couple of years, working with LaRouche, where, because he said, the difference between man and an animal is this question of how you, whether or not you're defined, your relationship to the world around you and your ability to know is simply defined by sense perceptions.
Because animals have senses.
What's that?
Because animals have senses. That's how they function.
Right. And LaRouche has brought up the case of Helen Keller, consistently, but also more so recently. And it just really fascinated me. Because here you have somebody who is really lacking the two senses that I think anybody would say seem to be the most primary and necessary, your sense of sight and your sense of hearing. So the question is how, you see from this woman's writings and just the impact of her life in general, but here you have somebody who clearly did not live, like what you would call an animal. And she writes about people, and I think this would be typical of what, maybe modern psychologists would maybe say today. or just, you know, your typical sort of sociologist, I don't know, who would say, you know, the fact that this woman can't see, the fact that this woman can't hear, she shouldn't be able to write or express things that pertain to the senses of sight and hearing, because, you know, she doesn't actually receive these sense impressions, so therefore these are not things that she experiences. And people really, I mean, you can imagine they're pretty freaked out and baffled that you have somebody who clearly became a very prolific writer and powerful individual. And she says, well, the fact of the matter is there's something about the human mind where, I mean, she recounts it as where the mind, there's something about the mind which seeks to create a sort of coherent picture of the universe. And well, she said in the case of herself, you know, she talks about people who say that she shouldn't be able to use things like expressions like color. And she says, well, the fact of the matter is there's something about the human mind, there's something about herself that tends to fill in different ways and account for these deficiencies in the senses, because there's something about herself, her soul, which is seeking to create this reasonable sort of coherent picture of the universe, which, I mean, it's one way to answer the question. I think it's sort of a provocative thing to think about.
Now, she never really, didn't she lose her sight and hearing at a very young age?
Yeah, it was like 19 months, I think.
Yeah. So she had nothing really to fall back on.
No, and no real significant memory.
Yeah. Well, Sky, let me ask you on this, because the clearly what we're talking about when we talk about creativity and scientific discovery is going beyond the senses. But there's a whole school of scientific thought, so-called scientific thought in history, which essentially is limited to sense perception. Isn't that true?
Yeah, you get, I mean, I wouldn't know if you'd call these guys scientific thought. Because you get commentary.
Mm-hmm.
You get commentary, and then you've got the actual discovery process. And so our focus here has been, you want to go back to the discoverers. You got to do two things. One is you've got to be going back to the actual discoverers, reliving their actual methodological approach. Right? Not reading a description of it, but to the best of your ability, recreating step by step, recreating what their thought process was. And so LaRouche's approach for the whole youth movement, and then for obviously us here in the basement, was to start with the one creative thinker who's most explicit about that, which is Johannes Kepler. His New Astronomy is a massive tome, not because it takes that long to write down the facts of his discovery, but because it takes that long for him to lay out what his, a whole series of hypotheses, false leads, of trying to recreate in your mind a paradox is the way he encounters them, recreating the frustrations he encountered as he encountered them, and taking you through the resolution in such a way that the discovery and the breakthrough at each point is your own. And so we had that as a model, and the idea is to take that and to use that as your psychological study, right? This is what psychology is. You're figuring out how does a functioning human mind function. And all the psychopathology stuff is maybe a subset of that. The extent to which you look at a pathology is not to the extent to which, you know, somebody doesn't like their state of mind or somebody else doesn't like this person's state of mind, but to the extent to which the person's thought process deviates from this actual human creative thought process, and then investigating why. But to do that, you've got to know what the actual creative thought process is you want them directed towards.
So in working on Kepler, you mentioned the New Astronomy. I also know that people have worked through the Harmonies of the World. How do you do that? How do you relive the discovery of Kepler on universal gravitation?
The nice thing with Kepler, which you don't have with some of these other thinkers, is that he's explicit about it. He really does give you step-by-step what needs to be done. And with him, it requires a lot of patience and a lot of understanding of the context in which he's operating, is obviously the case, because you're sort of taking him somewhat out of context to look at him today. You want to understand what he's intervening into. But then he gives you what he gives you what you need to work with. Unlike, say, the next steps in our project, which were Gauss and really even Riemann, you don't have a lot of commentary on his own thought process.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the next person that I can think of that you really do get a lot of commentary, who it becomes a project for, is Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Einstein works directly with a number of people who... Einstein is directly connected to the school of psychological thought, which was concerned with this sort of creative process, which wasn't concerned with which didn't prematurely jump to an analysis of pathologies, which was the Gestalt school around von Ehrenfels, Wertheimer, Kurler, and Kolska. Because what they said was, before you could really discuss a pathology psychologically, you'd have a very clear picture of what creativity was, and that's not an easy thing to investigate, of what, you know, what is the human thought process. And then you had these other people, you had the behaviorists, most of the schools of psychology that became dominant in the present day, who were taking an easier way out, which is, instead of having to actually study creativity, because they said that required too many difficult things to investigate. You had to rely too much on introspection, somebody describing their own thought process, and that instead what we should do is rely on, that the only way to be absolutely rigorous, they said, was to just rely on certain outward signs of a thought process, i.e. things, just the behavior of a human being or an animal. But the school that was opposed to that, the Gestalt thinkers, these guys, Einstein was direct friends with, in particular Max Wertheimer, who was part of this school. And one of Einstein's major projects was, you know, it's sort of funny, it gives you an idea of how this works, was figuring out what the actual character of his own thought process was in working on relativity.
Hmm.
After he makes the discovery, he launches a big investigation to figure out how did he make the discovery.
It seems like that was much more characteristic of something of a line of investigation. Specifically, the question is, what is productive thinking? Because I know that what Sky's referencing, you have Wertheimer's analysis of Einstein. You have a number of other things that seem like they're in that general sphere. The work of Kuby that LaRouche has referenced, which seems like up, you know, after, say, the 1950s or the 1960s, that question really doesn't seem to be something that's pursued with any intellectual rigor or at all, really, that I can see. That it seemed like something people were really grappling with, that came up in I guess, D.P. Snow's paper on the two cultures paradox. And it makes it that much clearer that the revival of that kind of serious investigation is something that you really only have with LaRouche again today. Because the most that you get, it seems like, looking at a lot of the modern figures in science is they tend to avoid the very questions that would be the most interesting to actually pursue. At least as far as that process goes. You know, what's the real character of the process by which the discovery is made?
Mm-hmm.
And instead you get this kind of bastardized version which avoids the interesting question. You know, people will say, well, you know, science is either up to a point was only deterministic, was only about, you know, sort of predictive laws, and then we made this revelation that you can't do that at all, that it's just all probabilistic and random, and, you know, you have quantum phenomena,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, we're going to have to rewire ourselves for that. But the thing that LaRouche has been stressing is you have to actually have a concept of dynamics, which is the thing that you'd have to address in saying, what is it that neither of those two views actually reconcile? The fact that you do have to look at the universe not as something that you're commenting on, not as something that you're looking to statistically to find a statistical correlation, you know, statistical correlations for, but that, as he laid out today, any unified field theory of the kind that Einstein was looking for has to take into account the action of the human mind, the characteristics of cognition as a defining characteristic in the universe that you're looking at. Because outside of that, then you're only stuck with determinism or, you know, or worse, randomness.
Right. Well, that is very interesting then, because it goes right to something that was one of the first things that I learned from Lyndon LaRouche on economics, which is that the test of your scientific hypothesis is the effect of its application on human existence, particularly potential relative population density. I presume that's it, Megan, that's part of the way you're looking at these, from what Ouyang just described. This is still at the central feature of economic analysis for LaRouche.
Yeah, and I mean, it's very clear right now. I mean, might as well just say something about this. He is intervening very powerfully right now into the situation in which you have the Treasury Secretary, all sorts of people who have been running around in recent months, but for years, with, you know, all sorts of crazy quote-unquote solutions that are really having no physical effect in terms of increasing the living standards of the population or anything that would look like that. So clearly, you know, there really is some sort of fundamental flaw in the way that people are thinking, which is what he's trying to get at with this concept of physical economy, where that is how you actually measure the efficiency of the types of policies that you have.
Yeah, this question of physical economy, I think we can talk a little more about that by going back to Leibniz, because Lynn has attributed the discovery of physical economy to Leibniz. And I know, Sky, you've done a lot of reading of Leibniz, possibly even some translating. What is there about Leibniz that was that took the work of Kepler and then went forward that does seem directly applicable to the advances in living standards and development of human society?
I might say sort of in broad strokes, what seems most significant. I mean, as a first, I'd state sort of what's most broadly, the obvious thing is that for human society as a whole, and we've got a funny thing as far as it's sort of every economic analysis starts with the question of, you know, well, all modern economic analysis starts, well, you get two layers of it. The really bad is the current view, which is that, okay, the problem that we run into is when you don't have enough money. So most people's view of economics is trying to gain enough money.
Right.
If they really do think a little harder, you know, if they're slightly more, if they're not just dirt stupid and they're trying to accrue money, and they're sort of, you know, kind of like an intelligent animal, they realize that what they really want to accrue is stuff that keeps them alive. And they've got a connection to money because money helps them get the stuff that keeps them alive. You know, if they're kind of not just a quite kind of clever animal, but they're sort of an intelligent animal and not quite unhuman, then they'll tell you that, well, economics is trying to get access to scarce resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that what you really want is you want to figure out, well, what are these materials, these resources from which you develop the things that you need in order to keep yourself alive. But a human being would recognize that the only reason any of those things are resources, any of those things are useful, is because human beings figured out how to make use of them, to do something, and to use them, to use cognition to transform these non-living and living elements, these otherwise non-cognitive elements of the biosphere, to turn those into something that will help to further the development of the human species. But that's creativity. The only reason any resource is a resource is because you developed some human individual or some group of human individuals was able to develop those things into a resource. So the intelligent thinker, the real economist, would say that the primary goal of human economy is to develop that quality of creative thought in the human individual. And then that is what ultimately gives you the, you know, gives the guy who's not thinking so so clearly. It gives him that stuff he needs to survive.
Well, in that sense, then, what you're talking about is that's the what your social policy has to be based on, organizing society to maximize that potential. We do have a question from an old friend of mine, Fred Unifeld, from down there in northeast Louisiana, who basically refers to the American system, and that's what you're talking about today, the fixed exchange rates, gold reserve policy, parity in agriculture. And his question is, who are the real enemies? Are the enemies who are opposing the return to the American system the same ones who are destroying science? Ouyang, you want to take that up?
I mean, I think you'd have... If you do a historical study, you find that's certainly the case. And it seems like the where you want to start from is it's sort of the way that Lynn views. You have to actually have a view of history. As opposed to saying, maybe we're trying to chalk up, trying to put people in, try to find a certain category. You want to say that there's got to be some view of a process, have some understanding that there's a process that you're a part of, and then use that as the metric for, strategic studies today. That is what LaRouche's approach is. And I don't think that you can really have an appreciation. I think you get a deeper appreciation of it in actually looking at what kinds of ideas are in contention.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, one of the ways that Lynn has put this is you have to view history as a fight amongst the elites. And I think there's a specific kind of polemical quality to the language there, because you really want to have a sense that it's not that you're not just dealing with some aggregation of events one after another that sort of form maybe as you look in hindsight some kind of structure.
Well, Ouyang, let me just parse this a little more carefully then, because from what you're saying, Sky was saying earlier that to really understand science, you have to relive the discovery. You really do also have to almost relive it from the standpoint of the historical battles. You have to place yourself within that, don't you, to actually figure out when you say the ideas that were in contention. That's really how you come to know what was a breakthrough and what was...
I give you an example. Like the work that we're doing, you find that a lot of the people who we're studying, if you look at, any of the guys of the, the 20th century, Einstein, Curler, Planck, you go before that, you look at Gauss, Riemann, some of them are clear, to different degrees are clear about the sort of combative nature of what they're doing, that there is something that they have to fight to defend, and that's clear. And what's less clear, which I think Lynn has been probably the most, has had the most precise analysis of, is exactly the nature of the political fight around this. And you look, you look at the issues around Einstein's fight in the early 20th century. You know, the fact that you had these quantum mechanists developed, or out of the same, in certain cases, out of the exact same institutions as the Austrian School of Economics, is not a coincidence. But part of it is frustrating in realizing that, but part of it is realizing that we have a greater advantage today to be much clearer on the kind of unified nature of the fight. I know that Sky has looked a lot at Vernadsky. He seems to be maybe the clearest
I was just going to ask Sky, because I know when I first met Sky, he was actually involved in the wave particle paradox from the first time I met him, only he was almost acting it out as a psychodrama. So, Sky, how has becoming familiar with Vernadsky given you some new insights into this question that Ouyang was just talking about in terms of the quantum question and these kinds of matters that have dominated 20th century science?
The main thing, Vernadsky is absolutely wild. First, because for him, and it's a hard thing, everybody, it becomes almost, when people try to reduce it to doctrine, it doesn't work. The statement that, well, there's no difference between science and politics, which is just, it's sort of people start punching the time clock, making sure they're doing enough science time and enough politics time, et cetera. Vernadsky sort of had that in a sense. But for him, it was that he was absolutely concerned about the development of the human species. And at that moment for him, he was clear that a large part of that was concern about the future of Russia as a nation. And he viewed Russia as a nation. But his political view of Russia was based on what his view of the human species was. I mean, he was a Republican in that clear sense. He recognized that the whole method of organization of the Tsarist government was anti-human, was opposed to the way human society needed to organize itself, as evidenced by the way the human individual had to function as a creative individual. Human creativity could not flourish under feudalism. When that he organized because of that, as part of his scientific work, he organized a campaign to replace the Tsarist government with a republic. Now, a number of things went wrong, and one part of that was instead of his view of the takeover of Russia, you had instead what took place with the Bolsheviks, which he viewed himself as something that was superior, was definitely advanced over the Tsarist government, but wasn't a truly scientific method of human organization in the way he knew he as a scientist knew it was necessary. But now, take that back the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
He recognized that because the pinnacle of say the development of the universe as a whole is human creativity. He recognized that this ability to reflect back on the universe again consciously was sort of the pinnacle development of the universe, and you only get that with the mind of man. But that in the same way therefore, these human studies of psychology properly understood, economics properly understood, that these subsumed all other studies. In the same way as that cognitive study subsumes both the biological and the abiotic, the biological as a study subsumes the abiotic. If you claim to be studying abiotic phenomena, but you're not looking at biotic phenomena, you're not really studying it. An atom, for instance, is not just an atom. If you're trying to study an atom as it sort of floats around and participates in physical processes or chemical processes, you're not looking at the atom as in all of its potentiality, because one of the major and most significant potentialities that exist in the atom is it's the potential for it to take part in a living process, and then for that living process to take part in a cognitive process. Since we know that happens, we observe that to happen, we know that that exists as potential in the atom already, whether or not that's taking place. So the idea that you're studying either matter or derivatives of matter, such as space and time, which are secondary, that you're studying that without studying a living process as a distinct manifestation of that, not as a reorganization of it, but as a very distinct manifestation of matter, space, and time. If you're not doing that, you're not studying matter, space, and time.
Hmm.
Well, now, Vernadsky is clear on that. So he says his development on Einstein's work is to say that, well, it's correct as far as it goes, but now you have to take this into living processes. You have to say, well, what is space and time as manifested living processes? And just today, you mentioned today LaRouche's comments at the Saturday meeting.
Mm-hmm.
He did the same thing. What LaRouche does is answers the same, this is one of the things that, you can start to see there that this question of wave particle duality becomes a different question. So you realize suddenly a lot of the paradoxes that you're stuck with when you're just staring at the phenomena as an abiotic phenomena are no longer paradoxes when you start to look at this thing in the biotic, especially in the cognitive.
Hmm.
You start realizing a lot of this stuff is characteristic of the cognitive. And not coincidentally.
Sky, I mean, this really gets at the curler question again. To what extent was Einstein familiar with Vernadsky's work at all?
As far as I can tell from the published works, no, though they were contemporaries. Vernadsky was familiar with both Curler and Einstein, their works. Vernadsky also knew a number of people who were directly familiar with them. For instance, Curler and Vernadsky, for instance, had mutual friends in Germany and other places in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
The political situation obviously made a lot of this difficult because Vernadsky had a lot of freedom to, he had more freedom to maneuver than most other people did under Soviet Russia once the Bolsheviks came to power because of his political role that he had played prior and then because of the prestige he had as a scientist and as an economist, that he was one of the major people who was organizing programs for Russia to take advantage of untapped potential as far as physical mineral resources and similar things. So his respect gave him freedom to move, but despite that, the political situation as it existed in, I mean, obviously Russia's relationship to Germany was more than strained,
mm-hmm.
sure. even in scientific matters, as a result of the British Hitler project that was launched in Germany.
Sure.
The better people from Germany, jumped like Curler and Einstein, jumped ship during that period to come to the United States, which really complicated things, was a necessary move, and it complicated things further. So the level of dialogue that should have existed around that period seems to not have taken place. Although through the works, there was a very high level of dialogue, which in this case seemed to mostly go from Vernadsky's view of the works of both Curler and Einstein. Einstein was aware of Curler's work through a close friend of his. One of Einstein's close friends was Max Wertheimer, who was one of the three people who were responsible for the development of Gestalt psychology as an outgrowth of Gestalt theory.
We did have a question that came in about this whole question of the becoming conscious and exploring your own creative process. I know you've done work on this that's up on the website in terms of an interview. Are we putting out some written material on this whole question of the relationship of applying Vernadsky to the Einstein question? Will we be seeing that in Dunamis sometime soon, or are there articles in process?
Yeah, this is a tricky thing because the real question is, well, how do you inject this as a... Because there's an urgency, and in a certain sense, you know, we're losing time and there's an urgency, and there's an urgent need for us to disseminate these ideas into the population,
mm-hmm.
because the population is woefully lacking of the ability to even recognize that any longer that this type of creativity exists in the human individual. They've been brainwashed with, you know, really bullshit ideas like scientific method, which is trying to reduce the creative thought process to a series of steps, a series of rules, which none of these guys use. So the necessity right now is to communicate that kind of, this sort of creative process to the population in a way, as efficient a manner as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That this will require, obviously, I would think it would be done, it's communicated most efficiently in written form and being able to help to taking people, creating something where somebody can reenact for themselves the same discovery process. But because of the limitations in the population, you also need other ways to inject it.
Well, let me suggest one, and I want to pose this to Megan, which is the relationship between science and culture, this question of cognition, which can be seen through, for example, performing choral music. And some people say, well, why does LaRouche have the youth movement? Okay, maybe I get the Einstein question and the science question, but why do they sing? And Megan, I'd like to throw that out to you. To what extent do you think the music work can help make accessible to people who otherwise live in a completely degenerate, banal culture? How does going back to Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, bring these same kinds of questions forward?
Well, I think... I think there's sort of two sides to it. One is, you know, the person on the receiving end, the person you know, is in an audience where these things are being performed. Then on the other side, which I think in a way can be more more personal and powerful in a way, is when people realize that they were constructed, their biological apparatus was constructed in such a way where you can sing in a very beautiful and powerful way, which is the bel canto of method of singing, which we are working on here. And I think, you know, that in and of itself, I think anybody who has is engaged in the music program that we have, and who had never, who sort of had this idea that, you know, singing is something that, you know, like anything, is sort of a fluke. You know, beautiful music, that's something that some people were sort of born to do, but others not. And the fact that that is sort of a universal characteristic that you have present in every human being, in and of itself, I think is something very powerful to realize. And then then also realizing and seeing. I mean, it's also a very it's a very tangible sort of way of somebody seeing themselves creating something, actually being creative, the production, the performance of a beautiful piece of music, using your own physical apparatus. It's sort of interesting that, I mean, the fact that you're able to do that, and that it's definitely something that I think most people for most of their lives would say, you know, was not a capability that they had, can be something very powerful. As I said, it's you know, you yourself are then actually being creative in a very real sense. And then on the other end, on the other end of that, for people who haven't learned to sing, or, you know, who aren't musicians themselves, I mean, it's a hard thing to describe in terms of the mechanics sort of what's actually going on when somebody is, you know, when somebody's listening to a piece by a choral piece by Bach or a sonata of Beethoven or Mozart. I don't know that I want to say too much about it, but I think anybody could say that there's definitely an interesting relationship that the pieces of those composers have to the mind and a certain process that's going on in the mind. It's a little bit of a hard thing to describe,
but there's a certain resonance there. I think what you're saying does get back to this point that we're making, and that what we're really looking at, whether you're dealing with science, whether you're dealing with music, Kepler was actually right in his identification as a universal branch of science, which he called harmonics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're looking at. Now, we have just a little more than 10 minutes to go, and I wanted to bring up one other question that was asked by one of our supporters, who, when he heard this was going to be the topic today, he said, "I want to know from one of these guys why LaRouche has a bug up his butt about mathematics." So, Ouyang, Sky, Megan, any of you want to discuss what the problem is with mathematics?
I mean, I'll say the obvious one is that, look, it's in general, and you see it a lot right now culturally, people are limited most in their ability to express and tackle profound ideas by their language. And language is a very broad thing. Language is not just, you know, your vocabulary, say, but it's what Megan was just describing. Your ability to communicate an idea does stem from your ability to manage musicality, your ability to use inflection, tone, and these kinds of things. If you can't do that, you're limited in what kinds of concepts you can convey. I mean, think about text messaging, right? You can use this, even if you have a decent vocabulary in text messaging, you're kind of fucked over because of the cost of your text message now. But even then, you lose an ability to communicate certain things, and inflection in other ways. And so the last thing you would want to do is to say, well, the ideas that I can express are dependent upon the extent to which, dependent on the development of my language thus far. Because a new idea, a really new idea, will necessitate a change in the language. Now, the same is true with mathematics. The trouble is, really, in the same way as an idea, a new idea, is killed by the insistence of using an old language, which happens in arguments. People are familiar with this, have actually tried to communicate to somebody something fundamentally new, and you realize that your idea is killed by their insistence that you present the idea in terms that they understand. Because if it was the things they understand, that what you're presenting is outside of what they already understand. You can't use the terminology they expect you to use. And the same thing happens all the time with ideas, you know, potential scientific ideas, which is that they're destroyed by the attempt to express them using an existing language. The existing language is not written in stone. The existing mathematics are not written in stone. They are something that, in each case, were created by somebody trying to express something new. In the case of the calculus, it was developed because of conceptually what, in sequence, Kuza, then Kepler, then Leibniz were trying to communicate. And then Leibniz refines it to a point of perfection. But then it's taken further. Gauss and then Riemann realize that it's limited in what it can express. And when you get to Verdadsky, you realize that all of the existing mathematics are incapable of expressing what he's describing with the biotic. And then we realize the exact same thing when you start to look at what LaRouche is working on in economics, that what he is describing cannot be reduced to the existing mathematics. Maybe a new mathematics can be developed, but it'll require a poet. It won't require somebody who's skilled in the existing mathematics. It'll require somebody who understands the idea clearly enough and is possessed with the capability of poetic expression that will allow them to create the mathematics that are required.
Oh, that was pretty good. Quick, in the time remaining, let me just ask each of you to talk about what you're going to be working on in the weeks and months ahead and what this will mean in terms of the fight to reverse this dark age and create a new renaissance.
Well, I can say
there's an ambitious question for you.
Yeah, it's left.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm gonna spread the pain a little bit by saying it's gonna be tackled by a number of people. Hopefully, everybody who's listening at least. But we're planning on having a conference toward the end of the month. Which is going to be organized around the theme of dynamics. Our particular line of work at this stage in the basement has been to take, as a broad sweep, the arc of development from Einstein and Vernadsky, looking back at Kepler and Riemann and the particular kind of approach that is embodied in their work, and so we're well on that path, at least the initial stages of it, in trying to get around some of the unfinished, sort of unanswered questions that haven't really been taken up in a systematic way, in a serious way, for the last 60 or 70 years since Einstein and Vernadsky died. And, you know, which LaRouche has been virtually alone in raising as issues that have to be the defining issues of science. So I think the idea that he laid out today, and which is going to be in a paper that he's writing for an upcoming conference in Kiev that he'll be submitting, is hopefully lays out the horizon as far as I can see it right now, which is... you know, the idea of recognizing the importance of cognition and the organizing hierarchy amongst the noetic, the biotic, and the abiotic in tackling the conception of a unified field theory that Einstein had posed in his work.
And what would be the most immediate indication that you're making progress in this? Guy, you want to take that up?
Well, the clearest thing is going to be to the extent to which we get ourselves as a political movement to increase our capability to communicate this quality of idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's developing. That we're seeing, that we're already seeing move. And the trick is to keep that going, to sort of keep finding the, as Lynn stressed today, find the difficult areas. You know, find the places where, the way he phrased it is that you want to, you always want to find the things that you can't do yet. Figure out how to do it, and then to do it at a rate that's faster than you think you're capable of doing it. And if we can do that ourselves, we can get ourselves to do it as a movement. Given the presence that we've got nationally and internationally, we can get ourselves to do it as a species. And I think that's got to be our goal.
It's also an existential question for humanity, because if we don't change the way people think, it is the case. You can see it with the collapse of employment, the collapse of food production internationally, the breakdown of transportation, and so on. You can see the immediate existential danger that's embedded in the present way of thinking and behaving.
Yeah, this is how we survive. This is what we are as a species. If we don't manifest this, we don't exist. And we're getting a very clear demonstration of that and what's taking place currently.
Sure. Well, Megan, you have any other thoughts to add?
Yeah, I mean, I would say in terms of what you said, you asked what an indication of progress would be. I mean, one thing that came to my mind is, the types of, you look at a country like Mexico, for example, which is, in the middle of pretty much an all-out war with the drug lords there. We have proposed, we have a video about this that people can access on our website, the construction of a major water project, cross-border water project, the Nahuapa Plino, which would be extremely capital intensive and transform the landscape of Mexico and the United States in order to transform the biosphere, in order to create more arable land for farming and whatnot there. I think the point at which you destroy, the ideology of something like environmentalism, which says that, something like that is sort of too outrageous and, not quote-unquote natural. I think the point at which we destroy that type of ideology and proceed with some of these extremely bold projects, and that governments are willing to do that, I think that would be an indicator of progress, one, in terms of policymaking, but also in terms of just the culture, because there's also, a cultural barrier there in terms of people's willingness to go ahead with those types of things.
Well, I think we can leave our listeners with that optimistic note, because the potential exists now, as also I know Mr. LaRouche was talking about today. His influence internationally, including especially on governments of Russia, China, and India, and increasingly with the potential to move the Obama administration, gives us the capability for those kind of bold measures, bold measures which break decisively with the monetary policies of the last 40 years, the free trade, globalization policies, and then that would open up the potential that we've been discussing today for rethinking science, changing the curriculum in the universities to go back to this kind of classical work. And I think in that sense, what you've been hearing today from Sky, Oyai, and Megan is the future. This going back to the past to get to the future. So I'd like to thank the three of you for joining us, and we'll have to do this again sometime. I know, Oyai, you said, what is it, in 2 weeks you have your seminar?
Yeah, at the end of the month, and hopefully we'll have an explosion of output following that.
The basement going global.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you again to the three of you today. This has been the LaRouche Show. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And in the meantime, go on to the LaRouchePact.com website, look at the new videos that are up, the day-to-day economic, political news stories, as well as longer features like Plino, the fraud of free energy, and so on. So until next week, see you soon.